Well, good afternoon, Michigan. I am so delighted to be filling in yet again for my dear friend, Paul W. Smith, and we're sending Paul and Kim safe travels as they are out and about. But I am pleased to be here in the Golden Tower with Mike and Danielle in the booth, and my friends Matt Friedman and Megan Spanitz here in studio. Making sure that all the mistakes I make, they throw something heavy at my head. So let's get started. Our first guest today is no other than Nancy Tellem. Nancy Tellem has a resume that you'd think is fake. She's been the president of CBS Entertainment Group. She is on the board of Rocket Companies and MGM Studios. So she is, you know, still playing a role in telling the rest of us what we're watching. She's the co-founder of Boss Blue, right in downtown Detroit, right by the beautiful DIA. But we're going to talk a little sports today. So, Nancy, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. It's nice to be on with you.
Well, it is great to have you. So let's jump right into it. You are the co-chair of the 2027 Final Four that is going to take place right here in Detroit. And how excited is the city and the state and the sports community to bring this back to Detroit after so, so many years?
You know, I have to say, I just got back from the Final Four in Indianapolis just to get a little bit of a taste of what we should expect. And I can't say how excited I am to be part of this as we look forward to the 2027 Final Four. It's such a wonderful opportunity to kind of show what an extraordinary state and city, especially Detroit, is to all the fans that will be coming in for the Final Four. So it's so nice to be part of the organizing committee.
So we had the NFL draft here just a couple summers ago, which went spectacularly well. We really impressed the NFL brass. We impressed all of the people who came from all over the country to downtown Detroit. What have you been able to learn from the success of the NFL draft in Detroit?
Well, first and foremost, with my co-chair, Chief Bettison, we know we can pull off a large event such as this. We also know that the city and everyone around the city will support it. And that, to me, the energy, the excitement that the draft brought to the city, not to mention all the economic benefits it brought to the city, was something that was incredibly exciting to us, and really we can build off of that for the Final Four coming next year.
And the NFL draft was an incredibly safe event, and I assume one of the reasons why you have Chief Bettison as your co-chair is to send that message that for anyone out there who still thinks that Detroit may not be safe enough, they are completely mistaken.
Well, I got to say, I mean, moving to Detroit, now it's over 10 years ago, there was this feeling, like when people would ask me why I moved to Detroit, there was this idea of Detroit wasn't safe. And I must say, you know, since being here, since experiencing all the amazing events that we have had, including the draft, and when I bring all my friends and business associates here, they are completely blown away of what an amazing city it is, how wonderful it is, how safe it is. So, like I said, I think that, you know, we can count on the city of Detroit Police Department, and I'm sure you're going to get more details as we get closer to the event.
Well, I'll make sure to have Chief Bettison as one of my guests the next time Paul lets me sit in his chair.
Yeah, please do. He and I went to the Final Four together. He was obviously, he takes this position very seriously. He takes the city very seriously, and he's done an amazing job as Chief of Police since being in that role. And I must say, I have full confidence that everyone should feel safe and excited about participating in the event.
Well, there's been a lot of confidence in the police chief. We're all very glad that Mayor Sheffield chose to keep him in the job. And I think that's, you know, completely based on performance. And later on in the program, we're actually going to have Mayor Sheffield. So we're going to talk a little bit about this as well. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Boss Blue. I wish everyone could go see and experience Boss Blue. But my guess is that a lot of our listeners don't know what it is. And tell the story about Boss Blue.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm very, very proud of our team and our CEO, Ellen Gilchrist, who has taken Boss Blue to a whole different level. When we created Boss Blue, and it's been open, I would say now close to five years, our focus was to give access to funding, mentorship, and networks that still disproportionately excludes women and non-binary founders, especially in the cities like Detroit. And Boss Blue is really actively closing that gap. It's a nonprofit, which we kind of reimagine what access, opportunity, and leadership looks like for women. And we really exist to remove barriers, whether that's with funding, whether with networks, whether it's visibility. And our space is really an extraordinary space that brings together everyone and allows people to connect in a very welcoming and safe way. Our approach is really community building. It's supporting individuals from, you know, very early on, all the way through their business growth and leadership. We address also personal issues that can come up. It gives an opportunity to really exchange ideas within this space. And I couldn't be more proud to see what a vital community we have created.
It is such a critical meeting spot, collaboration spot. I wish more people could go see it, because the space that you have built in a historic house, literally right next door to the DIA, is absolutely spectacular. It is such a beautiful and welcoming space.
Well, I really invite everyone to come. All you have to do is just walk through the door. There's plenty of opportunity. We have, you know, right now, I think today we have over 165 programs. Some are for members, some are for the community. And, you know, we have, you know, as soon as you walk in, there's no, you know, unlike other kind of spaces, there's no requirements or anything like that. So we just come on in and enjoy the space and meet people, and you'll see what an extraordinary opportunity it is for everyone to kind of be a part of a community that is so supportive. And couldn't be so proud and gratified about what we've created there.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much, not just for joining us today, but for what you and Arne have done in the decade that you have been in Detroit. It has really been such a big part of Detroit's transformation. So with that, let's thank Nancy Tellum. And Nancy, we'll see you up at the conference next month.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Sandy, for this, and I look forward to seeing you next month.
All right, Nancy, thanks so much. Take care. And coming up next, independent gubernatorial candidate Mike Duggan. Well, welcome back to Focus with Paul W. Smith. It's Sandy Barua, your radio intern, filling in yet again. Our next guest has been the transformative leader of the Detroit Medical Center, has been the transformative leader for 12 years as mayor of the great city of Detroit. And now he's trying something transformative yet again, and that is running to be the chief executive officer of the state of Michigan, the governor's chair, as an independent. Mike Duggan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Sandy.
Well, I'm going to jump right into it. So independent polling shows that you are now tied, if not with a little bit of a lead in some cases, with your two primary traditional Democrat and Republican rivals. As you travel the state, how does that feel? Are you feeling that out there when you're talking to the people?
Well, I'm calling you now from downtown Cassopolis. And if your listeners aren't familiar, it's right on the Indiana border, where I already had breakfast this morning with a whole group of people in Three Rivers, a little bit north of here. And it is amazing what they're doing. They've got this 500-acre development site where they're landing a couple of manufacturing sites. And I'm listening to the story about, you know, it'd be really good if the state helped us on housing. It'd really be good if the state helped us in bringing some jobs here. But to see the success that's going on, and this is what I'm doing. I'm spending my time in these rural communities, and I'm learning what's working, what's not working, and you can definitely feel the difference. People who 6 months ago had no idea where the mayor of Detroit was, they all want to come talk to me about their problems, and it's amazing how similar they are.
Well, say more about that, because I imagine when people first hear that the mayor of Detroit is running for governor, especially when you're in a rural community, their first thought might be, well, I don't think this guy has any idea what we're going through here in our rural community. But my guess is that's probably not true.
So you should see this. I'm hanging out with the village manager right now in Cassopolis. They are sitting on a lake that had been abandoned. They have rebuilt the lakefront into community space, very much like the Detroit Riverfront on a smaller scale, but it's been their central gathering place. They've taken vacant land, and they are recruiting against Indiana every single day to get jobs here, saying, wouldn't it be good if the state of Michigan gave us some assistance? But the most fascinating thing is they've got an abandoned township hall they turned into 7 affordable housing units. Of course, in the last 6 years, we built 6,000 affordable housing units in Detroit. But as we talk through the math and how they did it, it's exactly the same issue, exactly the same process. And you can see this, but it doesn't matter where I go, Sandy. Every small community in this state, you go up to Marquette, their biggest issue is they can't fill entry-level jobs at the hospital because the housing's too expensive. We have made it so expensive to build housing in this state, and we have so little help in the state of Michigan. You know, we're leading this country in people under 30 moving out, and it doesn't take very long between what unites the rural areas and southeastern Michigan comes to the forefront.
You know, your answer there really kind of leads me into our messaging at the Detroit Regional Chamber that in some ways, Michigan's house is on fire. Michigan is second to last in the 50 states for population growth. We are in the 40s out of the 50 states for per capita income and educational achievement, particularly evaluated by fourth grade reading scores. When you're talking to people all parts of the state, you know, let alone Southeast Michigan, you know, do people understand that we have this crisis and we need to do something different in the state of Michigan than we have been doing? Otherwise, we're just going to keep falling.
I would say people think the rest of the state is getting everything and they've been left out, no matter where I am. But the overall sense that we're 40th in America in household income, which seems impossible, people have not digested that in this state. They think it's just their area, but everybody else is doing well. And I think as this campaign goes along, it's going to be an important aspect of this. But I was just with the superintendent down here. They have virtually no high school CTE programs here, and they need to start them for the businesses they have coming in. And we just talked about the fact Indiana's across the border. Indiana spends $200 million a year on high school vocational tech. Michigan spends 40. And half of our districts have basically no programs for skilled trades, for auto mechanics, for all these good-paying jobs that we can't fill here. And so I'm finding this, it doesn't matter where I go, we're having exactly the same conversation. My kids are going to leave the state because they don't have the job opportunities here. What are you going to do about it? And it's pretty exciting, the momentum that's building as we talk about, you know, how we share solutions.
So as an independent candidate for governor, and I really want to stress that when you say you're an independent, you're really an independent. You're not representing an independent party or running for some nomination. You're just saying, I'm Mike Duggan and I'm running for governor.
I'm going to work with people of goodwill on both parties. I'm not going to get engaged in the state rep or the state senate races. You saw what happened at the Democratic state convention yesterday. It was a fiasco. They're yelling at each other and heckling each other and booing each other. They weren't heckling and booing Donald Trump. They were heckling and booing other Democrats for not being politically correct enough. And I think more and more people in the state are getting tired of this. But I guarantee you, the groups that I am getting in outstate Michigan, they wouldn't be showing up to listen to a Democratic candidate for governor because we've gotten so divided. But it's been pretty exciting that people from both parties and independents show up at all these town halls because the Democrats are going to their Democratic club meetings, the Republicans are going to their Republican club meetings. But I don't have any clubs, so I invite everybody from every community, and people really, I think, enjoy just talking through problems instead of listening to a speech about who do I hate.
You know, one of the things that we all admired about your tenure as mayor of Detroit is that you never fought with city council. And I know because you and I had conversations while you were mayor where the city council did something that was contrary to what you thought was the best thing, but you never attacked city council. You never, you know, disparaged anyone. And, you know, that is, I assume, the approach that you're going to take to Lansing should you be successful.
It was the key. We could talk to each other professionally. And there's $10 billion in investment in Detroit today as a result that wasn't there when I started.
Well, Mike Duggan, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your leadership and all of your roles. Be safe on the campaign trail and the best to Sonia.
All right. Thank you, Sammy.
All right, folks. That was Mike Duggan, independent candidate for governor. Coming up next, the president of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Focus on WJR. I am so happy to be here in place of our good friend, Paul W. Smith. And coming up next, we have David Jerzak. David serves as the president of Grand Hotel. And I bet that just about everybody who's listening to this station today has been to the Grand Hotel and has a special story to tell about their special time at the Grand Hotel on Spectacular Mackinac Island. And David, you're the guy running the show these days. How's it up there?
It's great. Weather's beautiful, sunshiny day, a little cool, but we are putting the last pieces to the puzzle to get ready for our first guest in pre-opening that will be arriving on Friday. And well, to make a point, for those of you that haven't stayed that are listening, you can still come up.
Yeah, well,
this year.
Absolutely. And first of all, I think some of your first guests are going to be the team at the Detroit Regional Chamber. I think most people know that the Detroit Regional Chamber has hosted the Mackinac Policy Conference at the Grand Hotel for pretty close to 50 years now. And we are such great friends and partners. The Grand Hotel is definitely the Detroit Regional Chamber's home away from home.
And it is. And we love the relationship that we've built over the years, and it only gets stronger every year. And I know that your group is coming up on Thursday to do the site inspection for the event this year. So we look forward to seeing everybody.
So speaking of site inspection, when your company took over the ownership of the Grand Hotel, and we still know that the Mussers are still right there, they still have their place on the island, and Dan Musser is still a frequent presence at the Grand Hotel. But you have done so much renovation, improvement. walk through our for our audience some of the things that you all have done just in the last couple of years to make the Grand Hotel even grander.
So we took an approach, a holistic approach, to look at all of our spaces in the hotel. So we've done restaurants, we've added a restaurant, we did a pool. Remember, that was the big project. We did bathrooms. And so now we're taking a step back and we're looking at what our next 10 years are going to be. And a lot of that is asset preservation. You know, we're just completing our year 4 of the restoration of the front porch, adding some elements back to it that were removed over the years. And so we see ourselves as, you know, complete stewards of this National Historic Landmark and a jewel of Michigan. You know, but what you'll see in front of you are the main dining room last year, the parlor last year, Baroque, a new bar that we built last year. We have a new bar that we're building at Gatehouse this year. You'll see some of the big flash. What you don't see are some of behind the scenes infrastructure changes that we have made. And I feel very proud to work for this organization and our ownership group who invested now through this winter $120 million in restoration and renovation projects to date since we bought the hotel.
Well, David, it is spectacular. And, you know, just even some of the small things that I've noticed make a big difference. But even despite all of the upgrades, I mean, you now have, you know, rooms with beautiful bathrooms and heated floors and things like that, you're still Michigan's, or actually America's, summer place. You have a portfolio of rooms and experiences available to all budgets. Not you're not trying to make this a Four Seasons.
No, and I think that we talk about this a lot. There's luxury. And then there's luxury at Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. We want to create an experience for you. We don't necessarily focus on selling rooms and focus on selling food and beverage. We focus on selling summer memories, something that's going to bring you back year after year that you can celebrate generationally with your families and kids and grandchildren down the road. Is it something different? Grand Hotel, Mackinac Island, same or not like your normal city. And we have something that's special on the island with being a horse community and carless. But at Grand Hotel with 388 individually decorated guest rooms, it's just special. And everything we do, we want to maintain something special and something memorable for people.
Yeah, and you keep that historic patina in everything you do, especially from the service. The fact that you still have brass keys for the doors, which I often have to mail back to Mary Beth Daniels after every trip that I'm there. So it is such a special place. But what's also special is that you are about to celebrate the Grand Hotel's 140th birthday, and that's going to coincide with America's 250th. birthday. How are you tying it in? How are you going to celebrate America's 250th?
So we're celebrating from day one. We have, you'll see on the outside of the building, some special bunting, red, white, and blue bunting that will be on the building. We'll add additional for July 4th, and then that will stay through Labor Day. But we have, we've established what's called a Great Grand American Evening to celebrate America's 250 throughout the course of the evening every year of the season. You'll see some little unique things that celebrate America. You'll see some unique things that celebrate our 140th season. But we want to make sure that, you know, this is the place to be. One of the first times in a long time, I'd say probably the last 20 years, that we've sold out for July 4th this early. And I think people around the United States are looking for places to celebrate this incredible holiday. And Mackinac Island is one of those.
Well, David, you have done such an amazing job being the stewards of this magnificent historic place that every Michigander is so, so very proud of. Thank you for the partnership. We look forward to seeing you later this week. And with that, David Jerzak, president of the Grand Hotel. We'll be right back with Carolyn Kasson and Megan Spanitz. Well, thanks for that great weather forecast. I think we're overdue for some sunshine and some warm weather, and it looks like that some of that is on the way. Also on the way, on the phone right now, is my friend Carolyn Kasson. She is president and CEO of Michigan Women Forward. Also in studio is my very good friend and my colleague, Megan Spanitz, who serves as the Chief Operating Officer and Chief Strategy Officer of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Carolyn and Megan, welcome to Focus.
Hey, Sandy. Hey, Megan. How are you?
I'm well. Hi, Carolyn. Thanks for having me, Sandy.
Of course, of course. So we want to talk about women in leadership, and you can't talk about women in leadership, particularly in Michigan, without talking about Michigan Women Forward. And Carolyn, you are the CEO of the organization. Tell us, what is Michigan Women Forward?
Well, thank you, Sandy, for having me. It's great to be talking about MWF. We provide small business loans to entrepreneurs throughout Michigan. We're an SBA microlender and a CDFI, and we look for people who can't easily get a loan from a bank. We also work with businesses to get ready for their loan and to help them create a sustainable and profitable business. Michigan Women Forward has invested over $15 million in 650 businesses over the last few years, and we're one of the state's largest microlenders. So thanks for giving me an opportunity to brag about this incredible organization.
No, it's certainly worth bragging about, Carolyn. And you know, what are some of the metrics? Because I know you and I have talked about not just the amount of loans and the number of women leaders that you have helped, but there are some real tangible outputs to what you've created, the jobs that they have created, the economic wealth that's been created.
Well, that's the whole point here. You know, I mean, I think making a loan isn't really as hard as it looks. What's really hard is building a business that lasts, a business that can survive all the ups and downs of the economy. And, you know, I say it's not for the faint of heart, right? You know, but it sets off this virtual chain reaction of being able to hire people. We've been able to see thousands of people get jobs. And as you know, because you run a business organization, most jobs are created by small businesses in this state. And so it stabilizes neighborhoods. You get to participate in the global supply chain and the local and the national and the state supply chain. And ultimately, the goal is that you create wealth for and financial resources for your family and for the business that and the community in which it serves. So it's really exciting and rewarding work, and I love to talk about it.
Excellent. Megan, one of our colleagues at the Chamber, in fact, someone who works on one of your teams, is being honored by Michigan Women Forward. Tell us who that is and, you know, what's the award for?
Yes, Katya Sabak, our Director of Communications, has been recognized as a Woman to Watch honoree at the upcoming Woman Up and Celebrate conference that Michigan Women Forward is hosting. She was nominated and seen as a rising star, both in her industry. We view her as a rising star at the Chamber, too.
Well, she absolutely is. So, Megan, you have several titles. The other title that I did not mention is that you effectively serve as the CEO of the Mackinac Policy Conference. That's coming up right around the corner. How's the planning going for the conference this year?
It's going really well. Bob Briney has been a very hands-on conference chair. He's very passionate about the conference theme, A Quest for Common Ground, and we'll be having a lot of discussions about where Michigan can meet and find common ground to move the state forward.
And the conference is going to be a little different this year. We've made some changes. Talk about, you know, for those who will make the trek up there or who are watching on the live stream, they're going to see something different.
Mm-hmm. And we're doing this really in response to feedback we've received from our board members and attendees that we're over-programming the time that people spent in the theater. And so we're going to kind of do that serious work, that thought leadership in the theater from national speakers, first thing in the morning every day, and then we'll break around noon and give people a number of different options to do in the afternoon. So some will be smaller discussions on topics like economic development, K-12 education. Some will be social activities. We know first-time attendees have a hard time, you know, navigating the conference and are there to network with people. And so it'll be a kind of choose-your-own-adventure in the afternoon.
Carolyn, turning back to you, one of the things that I know that you watch very closely is the number of women in C-suite roles. And, despite the fact that women have better college outcomes than men, we still haven't seen a real meaningful uptick in the number of women in CEO roles. Although in Michigan, we do have two new ones in Karen Carter, who was just named the CEO of Dow. And of course, we have Joy Harris, who is named CEO of DTE Energy. And of course, Mary Barra, who's obviously world famous. Oh, what do you see in terms of the dynamics of getting more women into C-suite roles?
Well, it turns out I'm going to be about 207 years old before we actually reach parity with men, where we represent ourselves as a part of the population, about 51% of all the C-suite roles.
I hope you're eating healthy, Carolyn.
I am. I'm going to be here for that, I promise. But so one of the things we try to do is really make people aware of this. And it's talking with people like you. It's making sure that we are articulating exactly why diversity matters. And so having this event where we're going to be honoring Katya, but also Joy Harris, who you just mentioned, Laura Dickerson of the UAW, and Linda Hubbard of Carhartt, we want to make people aware of it. People don't always know how many incredible leaders there are, and that these people need to be in the C-suites everywhere. And so this event next Thursday, April 30th, from 5 to 7 at Motor City Casino is an opportunity for us to start watching people like Katya and we have three others that we're going to be honoring. Keep your eye on these people. These are people. We point them out so that everybody knows that these people are available for to be rising stars in our community. And then we celebrate the people who already are the leaders in our community. So it's exciting.
So I only have about 45 seconds left. This is going to be a lightning round for both of you. Who is one of your role models as you were coming up through the ranks to achieve the positions that you have now? So let's start with Megan.
Tricia Keith from Blue Cross Blue Shield. I met her when I was very young in my career, and I continue to be inspired by her leadership.
It's a great choice. Carolyn?
I'm thinking of all the women that are in our Michigan Women Hall of Fame. I looked up to people who were unafraid, like Rosa Parks, one of my favorite women in the Hall of Fame is Elizabeth Whitney Williams, who was the first woman lighthouse keeper. You can be the first in something, and you can do a simple job, and you can turn it into something that gets you in the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. So kind of fun.
Carolyn, Megan, thanks so much. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Well, welcome back, everyone, to Focus. Happy to be sitting in for Paul W. Smith. We're going to take a few minutes right now and chat with my friends who have joined me in studio, Megan Spanitz, the Chief Strategy Officer for the Detroit Regional Chamber, and Matt Friedman of your own PR firm. So, Matt, let's start. Tanner Friedman, that's right. Sorry. So, Matt, you deal with so many organizations, both public and nonprofit, like ours. What are you seeing in the marketplace for nonprofit organizations in particular? I mean, obviously, it's an interesting time with tariffs and, economic pressures. How are they doing?
Overall, they're showing their resilience because of their missions and commitments to the community. But it's never been tougher in the almost 30 years that I've worked with this sector for them to do what they do every day, particularly on the business side, raising money and figuring out their revenue situation. Because of government cuts and uncertainty at the federal government level, and quite a bit of uncertainty at the state government level too, that doesn't get quite as much attention, it's a challenging time, But the people in that industry are so committed to doing what they do and so committed to communicating what they do that the relationships have been solid, and I've been able to still enjoy the privilege of working with great organizations.
You know, you and I are both engaged with the Detroit Economic Club, run by our friend Steve Gregorian, chaired by our friend Sandy Pierce. They have been super active, bringing in, as they always have, some of the premier speakers around the nation to Detroit. What's the latest at the Detroit Economic Club?
Well, listen to WJR. That's one way to keep up, because WJR has been a great partner, too, and I appreciate being able to work with Ann Thomas and her team to bring all that to life. But the DEC's main speaking calendar pretty much mirrors the school calendar. So they'll be active through about the middle of June and have a session coming up about the auto industry and a roundtable panel about the auto industry in about 10 days. Senator Slotkin coming in June, MSU Athletics in May. So there's really something for everybody there. And you never know when you work with the DEC, when Steve's going to get a call from somebody at the national level saying, I want to come to Detroit and speak to the group, and those things can come together quickly. I've been working with the DEC for more than 20 years. It's never boring.
Yeah. Megan, you know, in our shop at the Detroit Regional Chamber, you know, how do you assess the market conditions for, you know, fundraising and sponsorship for the kind of work that organizations like ours do?
Well, I mean, we're recruiting members every day, and members are joining the chamber. You know, with economic uncertainty around us, I think there's optimism in why a business would need a chamber of commerce. We just released our State of the Region report, and, you know, we've raised some alarm bells about the state of the economy, and, you know, members, you know, asked us for more. So, you know, we use local and regional data to help our members understand what's going on around them and what's on the minds of their customers and their employees.
So you say we raise some alarm bells. I think you might be underselling that. So say more about the alarm bells that were raised at the State of the Region event.
Well, we walked away sharing a key message that Michigan's house is on fire, that no state has fallen as hard and fast than Michigan, and some of the key economic indicators that matter to a state's competitiveness, like fourth grade reading, per capita income, job growth. And, you know, we did this not to point fingers or assign blame, but to provoke a conversation about business and government working together to turn the state around.
And do Michiganders across the state know where Michigan stands?
No, unfortunately, we just also conducted a poll earlier this winter and asked some of those same questions. And what we found is most Michiganders think the state is about average, when in fact we're very below average and in some cases in the bottom 10 in those key metrics.
Matt, going back to you for a minute, the last DEC event that I was at was just, I think, last week. And I had the honor of moderating my friend Austin Goolsbee, who serves as the Federal Reserve Bank president for Chicago. I know you were there. You're always there. What are some of the things that President Goolsbee shared that caught your attention?
I think that the big takeaway there is that things are worth keeping an eye on with the economy right now, but they aren't as good as they seem to some and aren't as bad as they seem to others. The one thing we know is that in times of uncertainty like this, audiences crave information and leadership. And I think it was reassuring to hear both of those things from the Federal Reserve here in Detroit.
Well, perfect. All right, folks, we're going to be back shortly with our friend Bob Riney, the CEO of Henry Ford Health. Stay with us, guys. Well, it's your radio intern, Sandy Barua, joining you yet again. And coming up now is my friend, Bob Riney, the president and CEO of Henry Ford Health, the owner of his own podcast, the infamous or famous, not sure which one yet, Bobcast. And he's also chair of the upcoming Mackinac Policy Conference, held at the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. Bob, thanks so much for taking a few minutes for us.
Good to be with you, Sandy.
So, Bob, let's first dive into the issue that you deal with every day, and that is the state of American healthcare. I can't imagine a more complex industry to be leading right now. This is an overly simplistic question, but what are the dynamics that keep you up at night regarding providing healthcare to your fellow Michiganders?
Probably the biggest challenge for me is the unpredictability of the financing arm, particularly with our government. And, you know, healthcare should be debated relative to affordability. It is a significant impact on the overall nation, but you've got to take a holistic view to what's needed to make the healthcare system thrive. And our job every day is to just take care of communities. And right now, there's a lot of complexity in our communities relative to health status. So, you know, I think that we've got to get to a point where we're having what I call adult conversations, meaning everyone's at the table at the same time, figuring out the best way forward while not losing the enormous great things that are present in our industry today.
You know, one of the things that every business leader tells me, regardless of industry, is that they are struggling to find the right kind of talent. I assume that's the same in the healthcare industry.
It is. And, you know, healthcare is an enormously positive profession, all the roles within healthcare to go into. But as we move towards a society that is really looking for the ultimate in flexibility, I want to work at home, I want to work the hours I want to work. Think about a healthcare worker, which still has to work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, including holidays. And so we have to recognize that there's a specific sacrifice that's being made that not many other professions require and not many other people really are interested in doing. And so finding a way to recognize and reward our caregiver teams is something that I think about every day. And as a result, we're having to get really creative about trying to attract people into the industry because, like you say, talent is in relatively short supply. I'm also really focusing on building the education pipeline in Michigan because there are a lot of Michiganders that'll make great healthcare workers. We just have to make it easy for them to achieve the academic requirements to do the work.
You know, one of the things that I'm so glad that Henry Ford Health does, but frankly depresses me a little bit, is to walk into one of your facilities around the region and to see those posters decrying how much violence against healthcare workers has spiked in the last few years. And that's just incredibly sad that our healthcare workers have to endure this rising level of aggression against them when all they're trying to do is help people.
Yeah, it's really disheartening. And, you know, I tell people, I'm always asked, what keeps you up at night? And the truth of the matter is I'm a pretty good sleeper. But the real thing that keeps me up at night is worrying about the safety of our workforce. And, you know, in many ways, it's a reflection of just the temperature being too high in this country right now. You know, people are just anxious. They're not sure who to trust. They're frustrated and they're worried. And of course, when you take that general anxiety and you put on top of it that my loved one is chronically ill or I'm chronically ill and in a hospital, it just makes for a real problematic situation. And then mental illness, of course, you know, and its continual rise adds to all of this. So, you know, we do everything we can to provide safe environments. We teach all of our caregivers how to de-escalate when things are getting very emotional. But we need everybody's help. We need people to realize that, as you said, these teams are here to help you. And sometimes there is not a solution. Death is not an option as much as, you know, we would like to think so. And so, you know, sometimes in the most dire situation, the last thing you want to do is lash out at your caregiver, because I can guarantee you they are doing everything they can to make the situation the best it can be.
Well, when it comes to turning down the temperature, you're actually doing something about that And the theme that you have set for this year's Mackinac Policy Conference is Common Ground. Tell the audience, why did you pick that theme, and how is that going to be implemented once we get to the island?
You know, I picked the theme because, in my view, the strength of our country has always been our ability to reach common ground, not to agree on everything, but to reach common ground after a healthy debate and then move forward as a country, as a state, as a region. And, you know, we've been losing our ability to do that for quite some time. It's been happening little by little, and then it's like a lot of things. It starts snowballing and accelerating. And it's really a point in time where I think we're at a point where we have to call it out and say, time out. Let's relearn the value of finding common ground. And let's have robust debates. We need different views on different vexing issues facing our lives. But let's do it with remembrance of the common goal and the common values that we share. And I just want to use this conference with a whole host of great speakers and your amazing leadership at the chamber to really remind people that this is the way forward. You know, this is the way that we'll continue to separate ourselves in the world as a place that just does things right. And I think we can pivot back. We just have to all decide that it's time.
You know, one of the things that I keep reminding people is that differences in opinion are not new, right? Since the dawn of, you know, humanity, people have
Absolutely.
Differed, right? But I think what we have really lost as a society, not just in the United States, but frankly globally, is the ability to change our minds based on new or different information. And that's one of the reasons why I love the conference so much, is because people do walk in, for the most part, with a relatively open mind. They are willing to listen to others. They're willing to listen to a new argument and have their own opinions or perceptions shifted some. And I think you're really playing into that with your theme and how you're guiding our team in executing this year's conference, which will be different.
Well, different's good though, right? And
Absolutely.
I think waking up every day with curiosity is just one of the healthiest gifts we can give ourselves.
So we're only down to 30 seconds here, Bob. What is one of the things that you're most looking forward to at this year's Mackinac Policy Conference? You only have time for one.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to having represented on the stage people that represent very different political ideologies, but will tell you how they work hard to meet in the middle because they don't want to paralyze the country, and they have to come to agreement to advance. That's what this is all about.
Well, Bob Riney, CEO, Henry Ford Health, Chair, 2026 Mackinac Policy Conference, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to see you later this week.
You are. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks.
All right. Be well. All right, friends, we will be back shortly with Jeff Donofrio from Business Leaders for Michigan. Stay with us. Well, welcome back, Michigan. I am so pleased to introduce Jeff Donofrio, the president and CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan, my counterpart in the business association world. So pleased that our organizations work so closely and so well together. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Sandy, thanks so much for having me.
Well, and I know you've sat in this chair for Paul W. Smith numerous times before, so I get to turn the tables.
I'm just waiting for my residuals.
Me too. When does that arrive?
Any day now. Any day.
I'm sure it will. Well, Jeff, there's so much to talk about, but first I want to talk about something that you, me, and some of our business association colleagues have been talking about, which is, you know, Michigan's economic performance, education performance, population performance just continues to shallow, and very few people are talking about it, well, other than people like you and me. What do you see when you talk to business leaders across the state, because the most prestigious C-suite leaders are members of Business Leaders for Michigan. What are they telling you about, is Michigan's house on fire or not?
You know, Sadie, I think you've said it over and over again, and you just, you know, summarized it really well, which is our house is on fire. And the unfortunate part is it's sometimes hard to see. You know, it's that sort of slow boil that that happens around us over time. You know, can take a decade or more to fall in the rankings like we have on, let's say, education, or, you know, two decades for the fact that we're the lowest in income growth in the country. So when we look around us today, we find ourselves really in the bottom 10 on a lot of rankings. You know, that's something that is not, you know, just because of one person or one party or one administration or one set of criteria. It's something that has been building for a long time. How we go about solving it, though, has got to be all of us together focused on the future, focused on what we want to become. And it takes leaders like yourself. It takes leaders like those running for office to speak the truth, to say, you know, if this is not what we want to be, then let's get after it. Let's come up with a plan. Let's set a goal. And let's be persistent in really, you know, making sure that we can get to that goal.
Yeah. And I so appreciate you saying that, you know, we can't point fingers at any one party, any one person, because this is a decline in the state of Michigan that reaches all across the state of Michigan that has transcended Democrats and Republicans in the governor's chair, Democrats and Republicans controlling our legislature in Lansing. So it's not just it's that party's problem or it was that governor's fault. We have to think broader than that.
That's right. And solutions have to outlast a term of office. It has to outlast a crisis in the economy, because what we've seen in especially the last 5 or 6 years is disruption after disruption after disruption. So how are we going to plan to make sure that whatever we pursue as a solution, it has a staying power? You know, business, as you know, thrives with consistency. We all thrive if we know the rules of the game, or the rules of the road, and how to navigate. And Michigan, unfortunately, has been inconsistent over time. We put a policy in place, or we set a direction and say we want to be the top in this industry. And then we change direction, or we throw out the plans that we had just a couple of years ago. So we're more crisis-driven. We're more reactive, and that hurts us.
So Business Leaders for Michigan, under your leadership, has been looking at the broad swath of issues that confront us, you know, population growth, economic development strategy, education improvement, and you've come out with the New Michigan Era Plan. What is the New Michigan Era Plan?
Yeah, you know, we see us in Michigan, and I think as a country, we're in an age of massive disruptions, where the gap between those who have the tools to succeed and those who don't is only widening. So how do we make sure that Michigan has the tools to succeed? The first pillar really of our plan is we have to make sure we transform education. That's the K-12 space, that's higher education. Right now we're 44th in fourth grade reading. That's unacceptable. So we have to focus in on solving literacy. States like Mississippi and Maryland have shown that it can be done. Both states were in the bottom 10 just a couple of years ago. Today, Maryland in just a few years went from 40th to 20th. Mississippi went from 49th to 9th. Michigan at 44th needs to look at what they've done. And that's a blue and a red state as examples. You know, the second thing is we've got to make it really easy for folks to be able to grow jobs here. We've got to be welcoming. We've got to make sure that we have enough supply and housing and infrastructure, and that it's affordable to build. Because, you know, it's not just about growing incomes. If your costs are, you know, outpacing your incomes, you're going to be in a worse situation. So how do we make sure that we can have an affordable life here in Michigan? And so that makes, you know, it really means making sure that government can help us enable progress rather than standing in the way. And then lastly, we've got to make sure we're laser focused on what are the great things about Michigan that, you know, the reason we're all here, the wonderful people that are in our state, the natural resources, the quality of life, the talent that we have, how do we turn that into advantages that we are laser focused in using to create the next economy for Michigan?
You know, both of our organizations, Jeff, have very active Lansing offices. And one of the things that certainly I see, and I know you and your team see, is, you know, too often, if the idea comes from a Democrat, the Republicans just automatically don't like it, and vice versa. How do we get beyond this, well, it not invented here syndrome? If, you know, if the other party likes it, it surely must be a bad idea.
Yeah, Michigan, you know, is a purple state. We unfortunately mirror a lot of the national political dysfunction that we see in Washington, too. What we need to flip is having purple be an asset to us, not a curse. That if we can set a focus, set a goal together between Republicans and Democrats and stick with it, that it's going to help us outlast any other competitor. It's going to help us bring ideas to the table that one party may not be able to get around on their own. But, you know, it is that consistency. It is really trying to listen to the other side, be able to start with what are we hoping to take on and solve for and go from there.
Data centers are another issue that has really kind of gotten some people pretty excited, agitated, in fact. And we see a lot of disinformation about what a data center is, what its real value is, what its impacts are on the environment. How are you and other business groups across the state trying to bust through that kind of disinformation cycle that we're in?
Well, first we have to look at what are data centers representing of the future? There is great potential in the technological, the analytic power that these data centers are bringing to solve, you know, some of the biggest challenges that we have. You know, how do we improve education? How do we improve healthcare? How do we cure cancer and cure so many of these diseases? I think there's so much potential, you know, across the horizon. Now, data centers are you know, a hot issue in the state, as you and I have talked about in the past. And there are a lot of myths about what, you know, is happening around it, on water usage, on energy usage, and what have you. We know that there are going to be impacts from data centers coming to our community. How do we make sure we have the laws in place and the regulation in place so it's done responsibly here? Because if we want the benefits of data centers, we're going to have to figure out how we mitigate the costs. And there's absolutely ways to do that. Other states that have gone before us show where the pitfalls are. And so we just need to make sure we have laws and we have regulations that are designed to take on those shortfalls and make sure that Michigan does this right.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for your leadership and your friendship. And thank you for joining us on Focus on WJR. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for your leadership, Sandy. Thank you.
All right, folks, we'll be back shortly. Stay with us. Well, Michigan, we're going to end today's Focus show with a blockbuster guest. I am absolutely delighted to welcome to the show the Honorable Mary Sheffield, the Mayor of Detroit. Madam Mayor, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Sandy. Glad to be here with you.
Oh, just such a delight to talk to you. So you have been Detroit's mayor now for roughly 100 days, and I have to say you have hit the ground running. You've had proposals around housing affordability, around taking care of our babies and our child care. You know, what's it been like these first 100 days?
Yeah, it's been you know, honestly, it's been a lot of fun. It's been very busy and productive. You know, I do say that, you know, my time on council serving 12 years really afforded me the opportunity to know firsthand the issues. And so day one, and even throughout the transition, the amount of committees that were formed, the public-private sector, I mean, everyone who came together to help shape the priorities for my first 100 days allowed me to be so successful. So it was good to be able to hit the ground running. We were able to, you know, launch RX Kids, make VDOT free for K-12 students. We expanded the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. We've increased funding for out-of-school time. I mean, we made significant progress in so many issues that I believe impact everyday Detroiters. So I can, you know, I get so excited thinking about what can happen a year from now if we've accomplished so much just in the first short 100 days.
So let's stick on the housing issue. So many people are concerned about access to housing, the affordability of housing. What are your goals in the city of Detroit to make housing more affordable for more people?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, we're working, of course, on trying to reduce property taxes, which is a longer-term fix, but we're in the process now of creating a comprehensive package of bills that we can take to Lansing that will hopefully significantly reduce, property taxes in Detroit. Secondly, we're also trying to just raise the incomes of Detroiters. And so when we talk about affordable housing, we often talk about the cost of housing, but not also the ability for people to afford housing in general. And so this administration's approach is to really invest in people, reduce poverty, build our middle class, and try to raise the incomes of residents. And then thirdly, I would say we're just really trying to make it easier, quicker, and less costly to build housing in Detroit. And so we're already in the process of just trying to streamline and reduce regulations, change some of our outdated zoning requirements to make it easier to build housing in Detroit, which also ultimately will pass that cost down onto the consumer to make it, less costly to build housing in the city of Detroit. So we're very excited about this. We also have a huge goal of trying to build 1,000 single family homes over the next 4 years. And we've had some very, very productive conversations with developers and others who are interested in making sure that vision becomes a reality.
Well, and, it's so important that we find ways to streamline housing permitting, yes. regulations, because most people don't understand that, yes, there's lots of reasons why housing has become so expensive, mm-hmm. price of materials, price of labor, all those things. But also, time is money for builders. Mm-hmm. And that's why they kind of focus on the more expensive homes with higher margins. And that leaves, normal people without a place to live.
Yep. So true. I mean, once I sit with developers and they break down the cost to develop a home or to create an affordable unit, you get a chance to really see the bigger picture. And so for me, it's trying to figure out ways to reduce costs, to reduce government regulations as much as we can to make it, easier, quicker, and more affordable to build homes here in the city of Detroit. So we're very excited about the work that we've accomplished so far.
Madam Mayor, shifting to healthcare, as I mentioned, RX Kids, and you are partnered with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha of the Flint fame and has done some really innovative work. So what is RX Kids Detroit?
Yeah, RX Kids is a cash prescription program that provides $1,500 during pregnancy and then $500 a month up to the first 6 months of a child's life. And there's no strings attached. There's no income requirements. And it really supports maternal and infant health. We're very proud to be the largest city now to enroll in this program. We have roughly 8,000 babies that are born every year in Detroit, and every single family that applies to this program will benefit. So we're very proud. I think we've given over $2 million to date in cash prescriptions to families in our city. And we cannot wait to see the economic impacts that this will have on our local economy, as well as some of the health impacts as well, too. There's been numerous studies already in other cities from both the health and economic impact it has had on their city. So we're very excited to see what the results yield in Detroit, but it's been a very popular program. And again, one of my first things that I did as mayor was make sure that we invest in our babies and our families.
And how does a family apply for this new benefit?
Yeah, they can go to DetroitMI.gov or they can go to rxkids.org and apply. It's a very, very simple process. And again, there is no income requirements whatsoever. Every pregnant mom in this city who goes and applies can qualify for this program.
And is this fully funded by the city of Detroit, or do you have philanthropic help?
Yeah, so we have a combination of money from the state of Michigan, philanthropic, and then the city made a contribution as well to make sure that we were contributing as well. It's a 3-year program. So as of now, this program will be in place for 3 years. But yeah, it is a public-private partnership, and we do thank all of our philanthropic support that has made sure that this program was a success as well.
Yeah, Detroit is so fortunate that we have one of the most active and, frankly, well-funded philanthropic communities. They've done so much. They certainly got us through bankruptcy and the grand bargain, but they continue to do great things. So you obviously are not new to government. You've been a leader in the city for some time, served on city council, served as president of the council. But I have to imagine that being mayor is a different kettle of fish. What surprised you most, even despite all of your great experience, what has surprised you most about being mayor versus being on the city council?
You know, it's really not much of a surprise. It's just more so being able to delegate, you know, the large demand of whether it's, you know, request of time and, you know, the numerous issues that we have and managing, you know, because now you're a CEO, so you're managing staff. And so just more so the delegation and making sure that you're able to better manage, you know, the demand of being mayor in a way that, you know, is directly impacting the things that I prioritized when I campaigned. So it's not really a surprise. It's more of an adjustment and you know, being able to delegate and handle all of the, right, the responsibilities that fall in my lap now as mayor of this great city. But I've been doing it well, and it's been a great adjustment my first 100 days.
You know, one of the things that was one of your hallmarks when you were on city council is that you had a very productive relationship with then Mayor Mike Duggan. And from what I can tell, you have kept that ethos intact as you now deal with city council as the mayor.
Yeah, it has been a really good relationship, knowing most of the council. I've got a chance to know the two new members. And this budget process, I really think, showed the strong relationship between council and the mayor. They had their, of course, their opportunity to do their due diligence and deliberate over the budget, but they saw, you know, that you know, I was someone who came from council. A lot of the priorities that I put in the budget were things that align with them as well too, and just the ongoing collaboration and partnership with council has just been phenomenal. So very proud of those relationships, looking forward to continuing them. I do understand that we're not going to always agree, but to have that partnership and those good conversations and collaboration, I think is key to Detroit continuing to move forward.
Well, Madam Mayor, we thank you for your continued public service. We appreciate the energy in which you are bringing to the office of mayor of one of the great cities on the planet. We wish you all the best. We look forward to seeing you at the Mackinac Policy Conference in just a few weeks.
Looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Sandy.
Right. Thank you, Madam Mayor.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
All right, friends, this has been so much fun hosting Focus on WJR, sitting in for my friend Paul W. Smith. Again, wishing Paul and Kim great travels. Love to you both. Thanks to Mike in the booth, Danielle in the booth, my friends Megan and Matt for sitting in. Have a great day, everyone.